There's only one Cristiano Ronaldo and his wife in the world. You have to understand, those level of people is literally one in the world.
What do you think about the deals that happened when in Saudi Arabia with Neymar, Cristiano Ronaldo?
I grew up knowing and having social relations with some big football players. So that was kind of like my access to that world before I decided to become a licensed agent. I was the youngest licensed agent in the world.
Is Cristiano Ronaldo only that famous because of his football skill, or more of it because of his personal image? All right, we're here with another episode in Dubai Catch with a special guest, Saif Roubi. It's a pleasure to have you here.
Pleasure to be here. Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. For those who don't know you yet, who is Saif Roubi?
Just a guy, mainly working in sports management, mostly in football, but also as an agent, but working various different sports and fields, you know, depending on what's required. And also have involvement in entertainment and hospitality, food and beverage here and there.
This is an interesting field that I always wanted to know about. And just knowing about, we usually know the sports, we see it in the front line, we see the football players playing football, playing the sport.
That's right.
We never see the behind the scenes, the sport management, what is happening behind the scenes. How do you as yourself get into that such business? I'm just curious.
I mean, nowadays, obviously, there's lots of very, very big sports agencies, management companies that are obviously backed very heavily financially. So they kind of probably follow the typical management, talent management, let's call it, route. Obviously, when I started, it wasn't like that. When I got my license to be a football agent, I was the youngest licensed agent in the world. And I didn't actually work for any big companies. I just started up on my own from the bottom and sort of worked my way up and learned as I went along.
Were you in any case playing those sports before you even joined this?
No. What I was doing is I was in nightlife in London growing up as a kid. Let's say 17, 18, 19 years old. I grew up knowing and having social relations with some big football players at the time who were my age. So your Frank Lampard, your John Terry's, Rio Ferdinand's at the time. So that was kind of like my access to that world before I decided to become a licensed agent.
All right. And just going that route, is it because of the connections that you had with them that you felt like you could add value there?
For sure. I mean, to be honest, somebody who say I wasn't a professional football player, I did play a high level of rugby at school with a couple of players that ended up playing for England for a long time, rugby. But from football perspective, to be honest, it was just the fact that I had access from the hospitality nightlife business in London. And I just felt that it's something that I can get into and potentially add value, like you said, and make a career out of it.
Interesting. And how did you know this was the right career you wanted to make?
I mean, I probably still don't know if it's the right career to this day.
It made you successful in some way or some form?
Yeah, it made me successful, but also comes with its own issues and problems and difficulties and headaches.
Interesting.
So, you know, it's like anything in life, you know, you get given the red pill and the blue pill and you decide what direction you want to go, whether in the end it was worth it, only time will tell.
You're still not sure if it's worth it or not?
No, I mean, look, we are where we are in life because we're supposed to be here right now. Mm-hmm. So I'm not going to doubt whatever's written for me. It's just it comes with its hurdles and obstacles and difficulties, like anything in life.
So going back to your business, FGSL,
mm-hmm.
What does it do?
FGSL stands for Future Gen Sports and Luxury. So I kind of just came up with that name because at the time I was working with different, say, future talents, let's call it. But it was just more to do with the fact that I operate mainly as a as an agent, middleman, broker. So my job is to kind of find solutions to problems. And the problems are, you know, football clubs wanting, needing talent, talent needing solutions and way outs of their situations contractually, wherever they are as a football player.
So when you're saying, for example, when you're working at top athletes that you know them at the nightlife, how are you exactly offering them value?
How does that work? I mean, again, the reality is you're, as anything, you know, your net worth is only as good as your network. So being in the football business, you have to have relations with the football clubs, with the people running the football clubs, owning the football clubs, managing the football clubs, and then having connections and access to the players, their agents, their families, their lawyers, etc. So being someone that's sort of floating in and out from the, say, sport, hospitality, entertainment business, I'm able to have the access. So that's really kind of like how I work anyway.
It's interesting that, though, you built that success or access through that little bit of network. But let's say someone who's just a junior, who's very young, just as you, 18 years old, 19 years old, who really wants to get into the space of sports management. How does he go about it?
I wish them all the luck, because it's not, you know, it's a very, very hard cutthroat business. The reality is, unless you have that direct access to players or the clubs, you know, the main way of being able to get into that business is going to be by working for a big agency or interning for a big agent and kind of like starting to build up a network through that direction, because it's not easy.
So what is some of the misconception that people have about what you do?
They probably just see the end results and the glitz and the glamour. They don't really see what goes on behind the scenes. They also assume that most agents don't do anything for their work or for their money and things like that, because of the misconception of the sports business in general. Because I mean, that really happens with most businesses, that a lot of money is flying around. But, you know, people don't say that about estate agents, you know, which is the same kind of thing. You're, you know, selling a house or a football club or a player is the same thing as selling a house.
So would you compare it as similar as a real estate broker?
For sure, because obviously you're connecting buyers and sellers. It's just different commodity.
It's like, you know who's going to be the potential buyer and you know who's the seller, and therefore you're the person in the middle to try.
I mean, I don't know if you know, but you might have an idea, or you might bring ideas, and that's where your value comes in, because you're connecting two sides who might have needs and problems and finding a solution.
What really happens behind the scenes in football transfers?
A lot. I mean, you know, football business is not like a normal business, because normal business is business. You know, facts and figures, you know, 1 + 1 = 2.
So what are they looking for when it comes to this?
Well, that's the problem. And this is why you have a lot of financial issues in football, because apart from, say, the financials of the business, there's a lot of things that are, let's say, reliant upon human personalities and opinions and feelings.
Interesting.
And these things cannot be quantified. You know, just because you might have data on a particular talent or a football player that brings him to be the best footballer in the world, you might not know that that footballer might have a secret addiction behind the scenes, or might have a big family problem or things like that. You just see what you think you see just from a football perspective. But in reality, there's so many different considerations when you are, let's say, making a sizable investment into a person, which are not related to their physical talent of what you do on the pitch.
That is really interesting. It is interesting that you're saying it's not about their skills in football, but also about their actual life.
For me, that's more important. What they do. For me, that's more important, because at the highest level of, say, professional football, all these guys can play. Mm-hmm. That's not even a problem. But it's who has the mental strength and aptitude to be able to handle what comes with it. And that is the biggest problem in football and in sport in general, in life. Because the higher the profile, the higher the expectation, the higher the responsibility, it all comes down to what goes on in your head.
So do you think most of the football athletes, their lives are controlled in some way or another by the club?
Well, end of the day, they're assets. End of the day, they are owned by football clubs. So whether that sounds nice or not, it's just a fact of life. You get paid a lot of money to do a job.
Mm-hmm.
It's just unfortunate that a lot of these guys are not mentally, psychologically ready and equipped for that responsibility, because they're just guys that are amazingly talented at football, you know, playing, let's say, as kids on the street, to then being thrust into a professional environment at a young age.
With so much money.
With so much money. And then they lose their mind. And that is the problem.
Hmm. So how do you ensure that most of those football players are ready when they acquire such wealth and also such high position?
I would say education. And obviously, unfortunately, the football clubs don't do enough of that in terms of getting... In America, they do. So let's say American sports, the athletes in American sports...
They get scholarships, they go to college, and they continue.
They're a lot more equipped.
Mm-hmm.
You know, to be ready for the real world, the real life, real business, finances, etc. In soccer and football, unfortunately, they're just simply not, and they are illiterate financially. And that is a huge problem in the game.
They got scammed out a lot.
I don't know about scammed out. They just wouldn't know any better. They make a lot of money. And, you know, that is one side of the business. I try not to get involved in myself personally because, again, it's hard enough working as a broker and an intermediary without having to deal with those problems, unfortunately. So, you know, if someone says to me what they should do with their money, I just tell them buy real estate.
Buy real estate.
For sure, because that's one thing that if you invest accordingly, then it's probably, not say the safest investment, but you've got the least, there's nothing guaranteed in life, but it's the least chance of losing money, let's say.
It's like a place where you can store your money and see it grow and you don't have to touch it. Like, you can't touch it unless you sell it.
Yeah. I mean, look, and then obviously, again, something I'm not really involved in, but, you know, people say like S&P 500, just invest in that. And
index funds.
Index funds and leave it in that. So if, you know, if I was a professional footballer who had a lot of spare cash, that's what I would do.
What do you think about the deals that happened when in Saudi Arabia with Neymar, Cristiano Ronaldo, and a lot of other football players there?
I mean, look, Saudi Arabia have their vision of what they're trying to do. And obviously, more recently, I think it was in Davos last week in the World Economic Forum, you know, Saudi said that for every dollar they invested, they got a $200 return.
Sure. I mean, it's a lot of marketing for them.
But that's the point. So for them, even though they threw fortunes at these football players, it was marketing, and they got their money back very easily because it put them on the global map in football. And they're investing and they're developing, and also they're investing a lot into the youth, which is great.
For sure. I mean, it's a very smart way where they shifted the image of Saudi Arabia.
That's it.
With that fast pace of just using those, which a lot of people consider as role models, you know?
What sport
a lot
does
of
that?
Millions of people follow Cristiano Ronaldo, they follow Neymar, they follow all those popular, and they see them living in Saudi Arabia in a very comfortable way. They're like, oh, my role model, the person that I admire, is living such a comfortable life.
That's it.
Yeah. That's a very interesting thing. Now, you as an agent in the sport management field, I'm curious to know, what kind of negotiation tactic that you feel changed the game for you?
For me?
Yeah. Like something that can be used everywhere, no matter what field.
Look, I work differently to a lot of agents that I know because I like to structure deals in ways where I try my best to do a win-win for everybody, because that's always in business, always a good deal where everyone feels good coming out of a deal, right? But obviously, there's always someone who may not be happy in a transaction in a way. It could be a selling club, it could be the buying club overpaying, whatever it is. Me, I try to always put a deal together that is, depending on who I'm working for, of course, because sometimes I'm working for the club, sometimes I'm working for the players, sometimes I'm in the middle. But, you know, the idea for me is, from a personal perspective and when I'm negotiating, is to always make it a value for money deal in the short run, because that way you've got a lot more chance of closing that deal, as opposed to, say, trying to get a lot of extra money now where the deal might not even happen. But that's just me.
So how do you know? How do you know you're making a win-win situation?
Depends on the contractual situation and the deal at stake.
Because for me, I could say, I'm like, oh yeah, I'm really making a win-win situation for this person. Well, the other perspective is like, nope, you're not.
This is the problem. And that's why I said to you, the problem is that in football, people do not, they lose their sense of business. And even football club owners are not, they go into it, most of them, as from a passion perspective.
Mm.
That's why obviously now a lot of, let's say, private equity American owners are coming into the game, especially in England and the Premier League, and they're trying to approach it more from a business perspective. But even then, to be honest, if you look at some of the American owners in the Premier League doing what they're doing, you know, some of it is good, some of it doesn't make sense, some of it is, you know, whatever. So,
interesting. So, what would be the advice when it comes to negotiation? How should someone go about negotiating anything in their lives?
ABC, always be closing.
Always be closing. So
just get the deal done.
All right.
Because problem is, people want to argue about minor details and then deal doesn't happen.
Mm.
Just get the deal done. Because end of the day, if for whatever reason you feel like you might not be getting what you want right now, you can make it back later. But if you don't have the opportunity to get that deal done, you're never going to know.
Even at a loss?
Well, a loss cannot be a loss. A loss can be a temporary loss that can become a very big win.
Okay. So get the deal done.
That's how I like to do business. That's just me.
What about some of the biggest mistakes that you see young footballers make when it comes to certain deals that are happening?
Well, like I said, I mean, deals or personal?
You could say so. Well, personal, like what would they...
No, personal is just wasting their money.
Wasting their money.
Yeah.
Feel like it's very common, like a lot of footballers to just finish?
Yeah, because you get a lot of... You know, when you're getting a lot of cash and you're buying, you know, fast cars, watches, holidays, you know, flying in private jets everywhere, wasting that money.
Mm.
It's a lot of money. It just goes down the drain. So, I mean, that's a mistake.
Do you don't have like a financial advisors behind them or just
supporting them? I mean, a lot of them more do now, obviously, especially with the big agencies and things like that. But I'm just saying they're still human beings. So then
they get tempted.
Oh, we all do.
For sure. I mean, especially if you're talking about a young person who's just getting loaded with cash, that is unimaginable.
Look,
like you can't find this amount of cash.
That's it. You know, it's not, I don't blame them. So I'm not just saying it, like I'm not preaching, because end of the day, we are all human beings. You know, if I was 18, 19 years old and someone was giving me, you know, $5 million a year, what am I going to do?
For sure. You feel like you're unlimited money. You're just starting your life.
There you go.
You're like, my money's just going to come.
And the problem is you feel untouchable. And that's when the big mistake starts coming.
And do you feel like a lot of those football players have come to a sudden ending that made them realize they wasted a lot of money and now they're moved out of the game?
Yeah, I mean, look, a lot of the professionals that retire who haven't invested their money in the right way, end up, you know, also they could have had, you know, they could have been involved in, let's say, marriages that, you know, ended up losing half their money, you know, whatever, things like that, you know, like, you know, human things, human elements. And then, you know, unfortunately, their career finishes and then they realize that they're not earning that salary that they were earning. And they have to go to work.
Because they lost half the money, most of personal family.
It could be whatever.
Yeah,
it could be for a bad divorce or bad investments or wasting money across your career. And then when, you know, when your career is finishing, you don't have much to show for it.
What about, do you think they actually get into debt sometimes?
I mean, if they're gamblers, if they're alcoholics, if they're into those type of things, of course, it's very easy. Well, everyone is. Again, it's human nature.
Sure. What about in terms of those top athletes that turn into generational wealth? How do they do that?
I mean, again, if you follow, for example, what American athletes do, let's say, you know, those guys are investing into technology stocks at a young age. They're investing into real estate. They're investing into, you know, you look at Shaquille O'Neal, has got like 400 pizza parlors around America worth billions, you know? So you know, but in it's funny because, like I said, I'm just using American sports because when it comes to the financial management of their lives, they're obviously a lot more clued up than, say, soccer and football.
But Messi, for example, he didn't decide to go to Saudi Arabia and decided to go to United States all the way to Miami, I believe.
Yeah, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, but he's...
Why did he decide that?
Well, because he was earning a fortune in Barcelona. Barcelona are almost, you know, have been, let's say, insolvent. Not bankrupt, but let's say financially crippled for the last how many years because of Lionel Messi.
Mm.
He's been paid a fortune for 10 years. So end of the day, when you've made that much money, you don't need that much more money to go to Saudi Arabia. But by the way, he's still getting huge money in America. Don't think that he's not getting a portion of TV money, a portion of Miami, a portion of this. He's probably making more money.
More than what he ever got a deal in Saudi Arabia?
I don't know. Listen, I don't know the details of it, but he'll definitely be getting a very, very good deal.
So it must have been like a wise decision that he took up.
Oh, for sure. And he comes from Argentina, so obviously coming from South America to play in Miami, it's normal.
I see. So let's go into the luxury part of your business.
Mm-hmm.
What do you do exactly in the luxury business?
I work with brands and, you know,
big brands. What kind of brands are you talking about?
Could be luxury brands.
Are you talking like the Gucci, the Chanel, or the...
Yeah, that type of brands. You know, I've consulted and worked with Prada quite a lot. So, you know, Prada wanted to get in the mix of, you know, being cool with, let's say, celebrities and footballers and things like that.
Okay.
So I've organized some events for them in the past, you know, with their flagship locations, you know, working with some big soccer players, some big celebrities in the world of music, connecting them all up together, you know, like giving them the access, but in a much more organic way.
What do you mean by organic way?
Organic way, because obviously as a brand, it doesn't have to be a luxury. It could be any brand. You know, if you were just going to write a check to get someone to do something for you, anyone can do that.
Yeah.
If you have the financial means to do that deal.
Okay.
But obviously if you are trying to position yourself in a way where you are more cool, then obviously that's the real marketing and brand building that happens. Because you then have an appeal to a generation or, let's say, it could be footballers, it could be anybody, actors, media, sports stars, but without having to pay the big money for it because you already have that support and that fan base of that, you know, and obviously the biggest brands in the world right now that have been built in that way have been built on that basis.
How do you go about, like, do they still get paid, those celebrities that get to join those specific events?
Some don't. I mean, the point is, if, for example, I don't know, Louis Vuitton, for example, I'm just using them as an example, you know, if they've got a fashion show in Paris, you know, they could probably invite anyone in the world to come and do the show for them, and that person is going to be happy to do it for just maybe getting a bunch of clothes from them.
That's it. So you say something like, for example, Cristiano Ronaldo or his wife.
No. They're different.
Okay.
There's only one Cristiano Ronaldo and his wife in the world.
Okay.
You have to understand, those level of people is literally one in the world. David Beckham, one in the world. But I'm talking about the rest, the best of the rest.
So the highly known athletes or celebrities, you still have to pay them. But the ones that are still...
Well, the ones you just talked about is only a dime and a dozen.
Yeah.
That's a very small percentage.
I mean, like, even the people who don't watch soccer, they know who's Cristiano Ronaldo.
Of course.
That's the thing. That's why it comes to your mind. Like,
yeah, but they're very, very, they're one in a million.
Mm. Okay. What about, like, person like Haaland or something? Like,
That's a different profile. Mm. I mean, at the end of the day, you know, if you, for example, say, who's more famous, Mo Salah or Haaland? Mo Salah. Because Mo Salah obviously plays for Liverpool and he also is Arab.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas Haaland's a fantastic footballer, but, you know, he's from Norway.
Okay.
I'm not trying to knock Norway. I have a lot of good friends in Norway, but I'm saying that it's a different background.
So do you think the country they come from plays a huge role?
Of course. If you look at Egypt, just like Mo Salah as an example, you know, this guy gets a lot of money in marketing endorsements from companies in Egypt because there's a huge population, whereas Norway is a small country. There's no brands that are going to pay Haaland big money to do an advertisement in Norway because there's just no money in it.
Okay. But Norway as itself is a very rich country.
Yeah, but that's a rich country. I'm talking about number of people.
Mm.
I'm talking about, I'll give you an example in the Middle East. I'm from Iraq. Iraq, from a consumer basis, is a huge country because there's millions and millions of people, a lot more than the UAE, a lot more than Qatar. So from a consumer economy basis, there's a lot more growth.
So do you think someone from Iraq, if he was a very professional player and very famous, would he be able to get a lot of deals?
Oh, for sure, because Iraq as a country is massive now in terms of building and what they're doing and things like that. Whereas, you know, UAE or Qatar, just for example, that, you know, if you're trying to sell, I don't know, Karak tea, how many Karak teas are you going to sell in the UAE? Not that many.
True.
You know, again, I'm just not trying to, you know.
It's the density of the population.
That's what I'm saying.
Plays a huge role.
Huge role.
Yeah, for sure. And what do those top athletes, maybe those celebrities, really want in the luxury world?
They want to be cool. I mean, end of the day, they already get paid fortunes for being a footballer. So end of the day, if you're then into, obviously the top ones end up getting paid by those companies. But the reality is, if you are a big footballer that's already getting paid a big salary, your next thing is to build your brand. And obviously you're looking to build your brand. How do you do it? It's by association and by working with other big brands.
Do you think those are the very top, they continue to do that thing? That's why they excel? Like, I'm trying to think about, is Cristiano Ronaldo only that famous because of his football skill, or more of it because of his personal image?
Yeah, but his personal image was because of his football skills.
Hmm.
You can't build up your personal image without being a top footballer, because no one cares about you if you're not a top footballer.
True.
So one comes with the other.
It has to be both, in a way.
Like
when I think about it, like I think also of the Ronaldinho.
Hmm.
Like his image, he used to be very popular. He might be popular today, but not as popular as Cristiano Ronaldo, for
example. Yeah, it's different. But then if you ask a lot of players who one of the best players in the history is and actual footballers, then most of them say Ronaldinho. Not to say Ronaldinho is better than Ronaldo, it's different players, different eras, but I'm just saying Ronaldinho as a player was revered. And actually, he was the one who helped and brought Messi up.
Okay.
In Barcelona.
Interesting. What is one thing that most luxury business people don't understand?
They think that paying for talent is what's going to bring their brand what they want. But in reality, I think it's more about being authentic and being real about what you're trying to sell.
Interesting.
That's just my opinion again.
So it's less about trying to spend more in marketing and more about what is your brand really delivering?
Yeah, I think it's more about the story.
So stories still have a role?
For sure.
Okay.
Life is all about stories.
So for someone...
If you don't have a story, people don't care about you.
For someone like Louis Vuitton, what made his story so incredible that people just dream of having any product on them?
Yeah, I mean, look, he's a bit different, but if you look at Kanye West, for example,
all right,
you know, he's been very vocal about how, you know, luxury brands have been ripping people off for years, consumers for years. So he was like, listen, I don't want to rip these people off. I'd rather sell my products at a low price, a good product at a low price, and have it to everyone to be able to buy it. And guess what? Kanye West will still make millions and millions and millions. Whereas, you know, these, say, high profile luxury brands like Louis Vuitton, you just mentioned, Balenciaga, all these companies, you know, to be honest, like, obviously that's another conversation, maybe not for this particular interview, but again, the way these companies have been brought up over the years, it's for a different purpose.
Okay. What about, this is a very curious question that came out of me. Like, what is the most exclusive experience you have ever created?
Me?
Yeah.
You know, it's a funny story, and I think it's probably, arguably, an experience that could never be repeated ever again which actually I organized a private dinner once with Michael Jackson.
Michael Jackson. Wow.
In Bahrain.
Okay.
Yeah.
Interesting.
So it was in the time when Michael was living in Bahrain, when he had his issues in America.
When he had the what?
Issues in America.
Okay, yeah.
You know, there was
so a... So how long in Bahrain? I didn't know that story. How long did he live in Bahrain?
He was living in Bahrain for a while when he was basically, I think, keeping a low profile from America. The one of the sheikhs in Bahrain looked after him. And he had like a record label in Bahrain. And I think this was, 2007, I believe, before he passed away, sadly. And yeah, and I was actually hired by the Formula One when they first launched in Bahrain to basically bring a whole bunch of cool people, let's say, to Bahrain to enjoy the race. Again, this is way before Abu Dhabi Formula One, way before Qatar F1, all that stuff. And I brought together a group of people. One of them was John Legend when he just won the Grammy. So right. That was when he first broke. I brought 50 Cent's DJ. I brought Tyson Beckford, who was a well-known model at the time. Callum Best, Les Ferdinand. It was a very random group of people that I brought together, and we all went to Bahrain for the race.
How do you convince them? That's the thing. Like, even you convince it was just the monetary value, or
no? There's no monetary value. They weren't paid anything to go there.
Really? They just came out of
weird because in those days, the Formula One wasn't how it is now. As an experience, it was like also it was much more exclusive in those days.
Okay.
Nowadays, Formula One's not exclusive at all.
It was like a place for high net worth individuals to network.
Yeah, but I'm saying in those days it wasn't easy to go and get that. You know, nowadays you can buy it. Anyone can buy a paddock pass to watch an F1 race now if you had the money. So even though it cost a lot of money, it's not exclusive anymore. Anyway, so yeah, that was it. And then took all the guys over to Bahrain, and in the end we ended up having a private dinner with Michael Jackson in the Sheikh's house, and he was there, just 20 people in a majlis with Michael Jackson. Pre-social media, pre-camera phones.
Wow. Well, I can't imagine that. How old were you at that time?
Oh, I was, like I said, I think it was around 2007. So it was almost 20 years ago now. Crikey, yes, like 18 years ago. Yeah, 18 years ago.
So you were, how old were you?
I can't remember.
Because I feel like you would be like 20s and your 20s is
very young. I can't remember, but it was a wild experience. I mean, imagine, you know, being invited to a dinner and Michael Jackson's welcoming you at the door. That's what it was like.
Wow. You got some really interesting stories of like people behind the scenes, behind the cameras, behind everything else. It's a very private thing that most people will ever get to see.
Yeah. I mean, like I said, I mean, there's pictures of those days, and you can find them online from that dinner. But again, they were grainy, old cameras, not your normal, there wasn't content, people weren't there filming video content, it was just
the regular maybe phone, Nokia phone or something like that.
Yeah. If that.
for sure. It's interesting that you also had the connections to celebrities of that level. Is it, when you're connecting with those celebrities, are they coming through you connecting with their agents?
No, directly.
And how did you build that relationship or your status yourself to reach that level where you're able to connect with those
people? When I was living in London, growing up in London, obviously London, not how London is now. London now is not a very nice place for anybody, to be honest, which is why obviously a lot of people are leaving the UK to, say, move to places like the UAE and Dubai, which is obviously offering, the amazing country that it is here now. But yeah, London in those days was an amazing city, and it was a real place where international people would, say, congregate to. And I was in the middle of, let's say, the nightlife and entertainment scene in London in those days. So that's how I got to meet a lot of people.
So you even met Michael Jackson there?
No. Michael Jackson, I met him because of the Prince, the Sheikh of Bahrain.
Okay, got it.
Yeah.
What about like 50 Cent and everyone else?
From being in London, being the person in London, connecting nightlife experiences, let's call it. And I was probably the first person, I was a pioneer in that in that respect, because no one did that
before.
Before, no, didn't exist.
Interesting. See, I feel like a lot of people that tend to be in that nightlife, they tend to build their socializing skills, which then helps them with being an agent and then building that relationship with multiple people where you can connect the buyer and the seller. And
yeah, I mean, like I said,
make money out of it. For sure.
It's great when it's great, but it's bad when it's bad.
I just want to know exactly, like, how is it really bad? That's the thing. When it can, you're meeting such amazing people.
Yeah, but amazing people, it's nothing to do with the people. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, when it's business and when there's money, people don't act correctly and don't do things in the right way. So that's where you have problems, like any business.
What about in terms of Dubai? What do you think of it as a place for sports and luxury business?
For sports, it's obviously positioned itself as an international hub for sports. You know, I would say Dubai is definitely probably still the most desirable place in the Middle East where people would like to come and visit. Let's just call it like that. But again, due to things like there's not a lot of people here. So from a commercialization point of view, it's not as commercially viable in terms of business, let's say a sports business, let's say as compared to say Saudi Arabia, where there's millions and millions of fans, the stadiums are full of people. There's
they
a
have
lot
a
more.
Higher population.
That's what I'm saying. That's what I was trying to talk about earlier. So that's the, let's say, the difficulties that UAE, Dubai have in terms of building something more financially sustainable in terms of sports business. Because at the end of the day, you can only pay so much where you're going to get a return from those particular events. So,
but I'm seeing like events like the NBA and UFC being held in Abu Dhabi from constantly.
Yeah, because they want to have the tourism.
Yes.
They're not getting nothing back apart from the tourism. Okay. Those events are not making fortunes for them because they're paying big money for it.
It's a lot of money.
Of course.
Yeah.
But what they are getting is positioning Abu Dhabi. Obviously, I grew up in Abu Dhabi, so I knew Abu Dhabi before there was Dubai, before there was Abu Dhabi. And they're positioning Abu Dhabi mostly, I think, Yas Island, Saadiyat, all these new beautiful, you know, destinations.
As a tourist hub.
As a tourist hub. So if they're getting that in terms of people coming to the UAE and Abu Dhabi for that, then they're getting their money's worth.
I believe there's a lot of smart people who think before actually ever doing this, something like this is what
you're saying. Listen, the UAE business model has been, you know, one in a lifetime. Because what they've done in this country in the last 20, 30, 40 years has been amazing.
So really amazing.
And, you know, I'm privileged and happy that I was, you know, even though I was born in London, I grew up in Abu Dhabi. And I got to see the country in its infancy almost. So
it was just a desert.
It was just a desert. I mean, I used to, as a kid growing up in Abu Dhabi, I remember coming to Dubai. And the only thing that was in Dubai was the Hyatt Regency Hotel, which is now in an old Dubai. And there used to be an ice rink. And I remember there was a Hurair shopping mall, which is still there, I believe, you know, in old Dubai.
Does it become like a nostalgic place for you?
Oh, it's massively nostalgic because I'm, you know, I wouldn't be the person that I am had I not grown up in this country. I wouldn't be fluent in Arabic and meeting some of the people I've met as a kid growing up in the UAE. And also the same thing in London, you know, so, you know, your personality and your life shapes by your environment. So I was happy that I grew up in the UAE and happy to a degree that I got to, you know, grow up in Europe as well.
What is some of the biggest business opportunities that you see right now happening in Dubai?
In Dubai?
Yes.
Sky's the limit. I mean, end of the day, I always tell my friends, you know, that don't live in the UAE or don't live in Dubai and want to come here. End of the day, just depends what you're into. I mean, clearly, obviously, things like real estate is massive here because even though the prices are going up and, you know, people talk about a bubble and things like that, the reality is in comparison to Europe,
it's still much cheap, less.
Much cheaper.
Yeah, much cheaper.
You know, for a price of a nice house in Dubai, you wouldn't even get a bedsit in central London.
And much more modern.
You can't even compare.
So what is the biggest business opportunity that you see in Dubai right now?
I'd still say real estate in terms of investing, just simply because it's still a very small market compared to the rest of the world. you know, value for money in the UAE and Dubai of what you get compared to, say, London is night and day. So you could get a nice house in Dubai for the same price as a small bedroom in central London, but I know where I'd rather be living in and owning.
For sure, for sure. I think here it comes with no property tax. That's a really good thing about.
Yeah, I mean, again, that's another conversation in terms of how these countries are built. And at the end of the day, in England, unfortunately, you know, you're starting your life with 50% of your money gone.
50%?
Yeah, because if you're earning good money, you're getting taxed high, and then you're losing more and more money.
So what's the incentive of even doing a business then if you're going to get taxed high?
There is no incentive. That's why a lot of people are leaving. More high net worth individuals are leaving the UK than anywhere in the world, and most of them are migrating to the UAE.
Interesting. What about in terms of how Dubai's rise changed how top athletes and brands operate here? Do you think there's any difference when it comes to that?
No, because there's no massive financial presence in terms of sport for the athletes here. Hmm. It's not like, for example, there's big commercial deals for these guys here, because there isn't.
I see. So I see a lot of people also try to use, for example, those athletes that come here to promote certain events, to promote certain...
But that's what I'm saying to you. But those athletes, let's say, they're not necessarily, apart from one or two of the big ones that we discussed earlier, you know, the majority of them are not getting paid to be here. They're getting, True. You know, maybe they're getting expenses, experiences, you know, flights, hotels, experiences to come here and enjoy the country, which is great.
Before that, there used to be Maradona. Well, before he passed away, he used to be a coach for...
Yeah, I mean, again, that was before Dubai matured as a country, and obviously now there's a lot of great leaders in, you know, Dubai Tourism, Dubai Sports Council, you know, and the government. You know, a lot of these guys are doing an amazing job. And, you know, the people that they work with are amazing. And, you know, the truth of the matter is what they're doing is working and it's amazing.
I'm seeing they're trying to leverage the athletes right here in this country, especially like with Coca-Cola Arena right now. They're trying to play Dubai basketball games.
That's great. I mean, look, this is what I'm saying. Like, but it's because Dubai, for me, in the Middle East, is still one of the most desirable, if not the most desirable place for people to want to come to.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I get approached all the time about athletes and footballers that want to come and play in Dubai. But some of them, obviously, well, most of them are ignorant, thinking that there's a lot of money to be made here, but it's not quite like that. There's only that bigger money for, say, certain talents.
Yes.
But the majority are not getting that big money. But then most of these guys, if they're, say, at the tail end of their career, would sacrifice coming here for the lifestyle, because it's a much better lifestyle.
It's also a very tempting lifestyle.
Well, it's just a much better lifestyle. It's not about tempting. It's just end of the day, who would say no to living in, you know, sunshine all year round, you know, great security, kids, you know, standard of living, services. It's amazing.
So coming to our last subject, where I want to leave something behind for the audience that are listening to you. What is that number one skill for closing high value deals that you would say?
I mean, I would say just focusing on the closing and getting the noise out, you know, draining the noise, because obviously whenever there's a big transaction, there's a lot of noise.
What do you mean by noise?
Noise, distractions. Distractions in closing a deal, because obviously everybody has an interest, everybody has an agenda, whatever the deal is, whatever the transaction is. So it's trying to, you know, get the noise out and focusing on the close.
Just get it done.
Yes.
What about in terms of the biggest mistake that kills careers in this industry?
Thinking that you've already made it.
Really?
Of course, because people just think if you made a bit of money or if you've become successful or you've won a trophy that you've made it, and that's just the start of it.
Miss it.
Anybody can get to the top. It's how long you stay there, which makes a difference to your legacy, your existence.
So don't become arrogant where you feel like, okay.
Oh, sure.
I've done everything. I got the things I can do.
Of course. And also it's being nice. It doesn't cost anything to be nice. Unfortunately, you know, people forget that. People forget that just being nice to people is a blessing, and it's a big thing to be able to keep as a human being, as a athlete, as a celebrity. It's very important.
Wonderful. Wonderful advice. Be nice.
Be nice. Doesn't cost anything.
What about in terms of, if I'm a person, I'm not in the sports management, but I want to start building that high network of just any place. I just want to be the person who gets to know that those high net worth individuals. How do I go about it?
I mean, luckily for new generation, it's not my generation, the new generation obviously got social media now. So things are a lot more easier. Things are a lot more cheaper. Things are a lot more easier to accessible. So, you know, which is why now the biggest, I believe the biggest economy in the world is the creator economy.
Hmm.
So as a creator, you're able to build your own brand. And obviously the biggest people in the world right now are bigger than most traditional, say, celebrities, because they are the content creator business. And obviously, a couple of weeks ago, I think last week, there was the 1 billion follower summit, which obviously is Dubai.
Were you part of it? Did you visit it?
I did visit, but I wasn't part of it. I'm not that trendy or well-known to be a part of it. But
how did you find it, though, when you visited it?
Like I said, it's a different world.
Hmm.
You know, the new generation, whatever you want to call them, Gen Z or whatever hell, you know, whatever name they give them nowadays.
It just keeps coming with the names.
Different names. But yeah, the reality is it's a different world. So you're able to create, let's say, a platform for yourself with very little, you know, whereas in my days, there was none of that.
You had to pay to be there, like for a TV or...
No, not about paying. You had to be there.
Hmm.
Nowadays, everything's digital.
Yeah.
You don't need to be anywhere. You could be sitting in your bedroom. All these, you know, obviously superstars like iShow Speed, all these kids, you know, end of the day, they're machines and monsters in media.
True.
But they didn't need to do anything. They were just being, and obviously, like I said, unfortunately, for me, it's unfortunate because the new generation also, when you achieve success in that way, it breeds a generation of people for me that are not what I would want my kids to be like, because you end up losing your mind. It's not real.
What do you mean?
Well, it's not real because at the end of the day, people think that, you know, having millions and millions and millions of followers and being successful like that by just doing stupid things on TV or social media, let's call it, it's cool. It's cool if you want to be known and make that money. But for me, it's not cool because I wouldn't want my kid to be like that. I'd want them to
try to do something to just grab attention. And
yes. And that's the problem with the new age and the new world, which is it's very easy to monetize and make money. You know, there's other platforms, which I'm not going to talk about here, which breed an even worse type of human beings and people and things like that. And unfortunately, again, that's the world that we live in nowadays.
Now, before I go to the last question, I usually say this question about people giving advice to their younger self, but this time, I'm sure you have kids, right?
No, I don't.
You don't?
I don't.
Okay. But let's pretend you do. What advice would you give to this potential future kid of yours if he was going to start in this world
that
is brutally challenging? What advice would you give it to him?
Keep it real. Be authentic and work hard. And build yourself up in a proper way, maintain your values, and, you know, don't lose sight of reality.
Don't lose sight of reality.
Yeah.
What does that mean exactly?
Well, because it's like what they say about social media, you know, like, being famous on social media it's like being rich in Monopoly.
Hmm.
Okay. I mean, it could be real to a degree when you're making X amount of money.
But it's not real in real.
Well, it's like, you know, obviously, like jokes in, like recently in America when TikTok was banned.
Hmm.
All of a sudden, all the people that were famous on TikTok, like,
they're no longer relevant unless they have fame in Instagram.
There you go. Whatever. I'm just saying. It's just an example. So that would be my advice to my younger self.
It's a different kind of fame.
Exactly.
Put it that way. I mean, like Cristiano Ronaldo, even if he's not on social media, he's still super powerful.
But that's because he's one of the most talented footballers ever lived, one of the most hardworking, one of the most, you know, guys that sacrificed a lot. So again, that's what I said about hard work.
Sacrificed a lot.
Yes.
What sacrifices would I have to take in order to become?
Well, unfortunately, nowadays it's not much because nowadays it's very easy. That's what I'm trying to say. Of course, I'm saying it's much easier to be able to, let's say, make an impact.
Mm.
Whereas, you know, like, I posted something on Instagram just talking about how in football 20, 30 years ago, there was a lot more men and leaders. Whereas nowadays, your social media footballers are more interested in posting about what they're wearing as opposed to their real successes. And that is the problem. And because they're getting paid a lot of money, they think it's okay. But again, it is what it is.
So what's next for you in FGSL?
Just surviving, trying to build, last couple of years, 3 years been quite tough for me on a personal basis for different reasons. Some of it was quite well publicized in the media. So for me, it's just about building different things on projects I'm working on and, trying to do some cool, interesting transactions and working with some big personalities or football clubs and doing some cool business and just trying to keep it moving, really.
Just keep doing what you do best.
Trying to. It's not easy, but, God willing, it will happen, inshallah, as they say, ever say, and hopefully it'll be a good 2025 for everybody.
Absolutely. And where do people can reach you if they want to reach out to you?
Social media, very easy to get hold of on.
Can you spell out your social media?
Safe PR, SAIFPR. That's it. Very simple.
Well, it was a pleasure to have you, Safe. I mean, there was a lot of behind the scenes that I never knew about you and I never knew about the sports management, which is interesting. It's an interesting perspective that I think audience can learn about on your field. So thank you for being here.
Thank you very much for having me.
Thank you.